Well, welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your calls this hour with Bob Berman as we talk about all things in space. It's an amazing thing. I'm going to still talk to him about the multiverses when we come back, and then we'll get into your calls. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Bob Berman with us. Bob, let's talk about the multiverse theories for a moment. I mean, it's bizarre. I've got a difficult time trying to comprehend that too, like the Big Bang. What are those possibilities of other universes out there?
Well, George, there's two types of multiverse ideas. One has involved itself from quantum mechanics, and it's one of the interpretations that springs out of the many worlds interpretation. And then there's another one that cosmologists use. So I'll do it real quick. The quantum world, you know, things happen. There's always choices. Even when you reach a stop sign, you can turn right or turn left. So if you go right, well, then the possibility of going left has disappeared forever because you've made that choice. And everyone that you tell it to or has observed it has the memory of you going in that direction. Now, quantum theory says all other choices vanish when this happens. But another possibility brought up by a graduate student from the late 50s named Everett was that all the other possibilities exist as other universes, other worlds. In other words, there's another you that did turn left at that stop sign.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were that you who turned left, that's all you know. You're not aware of a George that turned right at that stop sign, and there were no witnesses alive who would have seen that other one. They only see this one, and another world exists. So since there are choices all over the place, even when a leaf falls from a tree, it lands here and not there, but there's another universe where it landed there instead. And so that's one of the, you could call the multi-universes. I don't like it at all, frankly, but many people believe in this. The other one is more interesting, and it's one believed by cosmologists. The idea there is there's a problem with this universe if you want to be logical, and it kind of harkens back to life and God and things that you and I were talking about a little earlier tonight, and that is we live in a very peculiar universe, and the biocentrism books, like the one that just came out this month, spend a lot of time on this because there's about 200 physical constants, constant being like the strength of gravity and the speed of light and the force that holds atoms together called alpha, the electromagnetic force, that are just right for life to happen. If any of these were different, even by a fraction of a percent, you couldn't have nuclear fusion. That means you couldn't have stars.
Mm-hmm.
It means you wouldn't have energy to support life on planets. And or you can even have, in some cases, structure that would allow any atom other than hydrogen, and that wouldn't allow life either. So we have all of these physical constants that are perfect for life to exist. Do we have to explain that? I mean, if you're going to just leave God and religion out of it and just say, just logically, why is the universe so perfectly designed for life?
It's amazing.
It is amazing, and it's so amazing that maybe it needs to be explained. So the multiverse thing is one way of possibly explaining it, because they say, what if we're in a universe that has life and has all these properties that allow life, but what if there is a large number, maybe even an infinite number, of other universes? In other words, when a Big Bang happens, maybe there are other Big Bangs that have also happened and that are still happening, and all these other realities, you have different laws of physics, you have conditions that are not friendly to life. And there could be billions or trillions or an infinite number of universes that don't have these exact perfect conditions. And we just happen to live in the one that does. And, of course, that's the only one we could live in because this is what we're aware of. If we're here, if we're alive, this is what we must find around us. But in any of these other multiverses, you'd have other conditions that did not allow life. So the multiverse is a way out of it. Unfortunately, and the reason so many physicists don't like the multiverse is it also figures into string theory. String theory predicts multiverses, and there's no way to prove it, to observe them, to say it's true, to say it's false. What we say is it's not falsifiable. In other words, you can't disprove it as a theory. And if you can't disprove it, no matter what you do, no matter what observation or experiment you do, then is it really science or is it just some idea?
Exactly.
That we have?
Exactly.
And so the multiverse can serve sort of as an answer to anything. It's almost like the dog ate my homework. You put forth any theory and say, well, in the multiverse it can happen. It just doesn't happen in our universe. See, I'm right. I can prove it. And in string theory, where there's 11 different dimensions, not just the four that we know about, one of time and three of length, width, and depth, the multiverse is an excuse to make things seem like they're possible when we have no other evidence that they might be. And because of that, many scientists don't like it.
What about black holes? What's inside of those things?
Well, those are real because we actually observe them and observe conditions. And Einstein told us that if a star is massive enough, more than 3.5 times heavier than our sun weighs 333,000 times more than Earth. So if you have a star that's more than a little bit more than a million times heavier than Earth, in its old age, when its core energy is no longer up to the task, it can't hold back the weight of all the layers above the core, and the star starts collapsing. And once you collapse, because you're smaller, the gravity is now stronger at the surface, which makes you collapse even smaller. And now the gravity is even stronger at the surface, which makes you implode more and more and faster. And if you just follow relativity, Einstein's relativity, you have to end up with a black hole. Bad name, because it has the word hole in it, which suggests it's a place of emptiness, a hole is like nothingness. But a black hole is the opposite. Here there's so much material that's packed so tightly together that it's almost unimaginable. So it's only black because light can't escape. The gravity is so strong, or if you prefer, space-time is so warped around it, that all paths out of the black hole bend back into the black hole. And so we can't see them because any light trying to escape goes right back into it. And we know these things are real. Like just before a black hole, you get to a stage called a neutron star, and we see those, for example, in the Crab pulsar. Picture this. A cruise ship where every ton of that steel from the cruise ship or an aircraft carrier, if you prefer, is crushed down and down and down until it's now only the size of the ball in a ballpoint pen. Now, picture a ballpoint pen tip weighing the same as an aircraft carrier or a cruise ship. How dense, how packed, unimaginably packed all that steel would have to be to have all that steel still present, but only in the volume.
Squeezed into a little tiny dot, huh?
Yes. Now, that's real, because we actually observe these things. Those are neutron stars. So when you get to a black hole, you're only going a little further than that. You're squeezing a little bit more, and then you get to black hole density. So they're no longer theoretical. By the way, do you know why we can know that Earth's not flat?
Among many reasons, but tell me yours.
Give you a new one. We can be sure Earth's not flat, because if it was, all the cats would have knocked everything off the edge by now.
Why do some people believe the Earth is flat when you clearly, pictures from space show it is oval and round?
That's right, and astronauts say it is. It's part of the... let's call it a conspiracy or disbelieving in the government. And I almost don't blame them because...
some of that is true, right?
Yes, the government has been known to lie. So the people who think that it lies about everything, well, then you just take the opposite of what the government says. If the government says the Earth is round, then the truth must be the opposite, that the Earth is flat. But the reason it's silly is because this one's so easy to prove. If you don't want to believe... pictures from space, photographs. You don't want to believe astronauts because they work for the government. Maybe they're lying. Fortunately, everybody, you and I and everybody, can prove to themselves, without trusting the government, whether the Earth is flat or round. I'll tell you the easiest way is if you live on the East Coast, let's say in Vermont, call up friends in California when any day that the sun is just setting for you in Vermont and ask your friend where the sun is in the sky. And they'll tell you the sun is, about halfway up the western sky, halfway between straight up and on the horizon. Now, if the sun is setting for you in Vermont, it's on the horizon, but it's high up in the sky in California, then Earth can't be flat.
That's a good point. To the calls we go. Let's pick it up by going to Cornelius in Alexandria, Louisiana. Hello there, sir.
Hey, George and Bob. Hey, George, I got a quick idea for you. Whitney Houston gave a great rendition right after September 11th in the Super Bowl. That would be a great Star Spangled Banner anthem to play, because I know you like playing good music and stuff like that, and I hope you do a tribute to Tony Bennett and do something with Larry King Live where you interviewed him, and I think Art Bell was on there too. Now, Bob, I was just telling our friend Tommy, I'm kind of against you on prophecy. George knows me as the God, Guns, and Gold man, the Bible, Bullets, and Beans man. And my thing with prophecy and everything, Bob, but I'm glad you believe in God. God formed everything out of nothing. The God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit formed everything out of a void and spoke it into existence by just speaking the word. But on prophecy, I believe with the end times and stuff, Israel is in the land now, and we're getting close to this cashless society, as you can see, and also with wearing these masks that are mandatory now. And that's the way the mark of the beast is going to be. It's going to be a mandatory thing. They may even go mandatory vaccines. I see now, George, I hope you don't have to take it. I know you don't want to take it. But to get on a plane or something like that and get on mass transit, of course, now you got to wear a mask. But I believe they're going to make the vaccine mandatory. But
well,
like I said,
they
Bible
may.
Prophecy, it's all in the Bible. But, Bob, God bless you. I really enjoy the show. George, God bless you.
Interesting points there. Go ahead, Bobby.
No, I'm just saying thank you. Thank you for your kind words. So far as vaccines go, you know, I shouldn't give my opinion on this, but I lost three friends to COVID 2 weeks ago. Three people died.
That's horrible. Horrible.
So when I'm seeing that, to me, the vaccine is the lesser of two evils. But that's me. Everybody's free to choose, I think.
That is it's a rough situation, and regardless of how you think, it really is. Richard is with us in Ohio. Welcome to the program. Hi, Richard.
Hello. This is my first time calling here. I've listened for years.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad you got through.
But I couldn't let it pass. Your guest tonight said that you don't know too many scientists believe in God. But I've been watching this one scientist. He's on YouTube. His name is Dr. James Tour, T-O-U-R. And he says he believes in God, and he says he knows a lot of scientists believe in God that he talks to.
Yep, it's true, there are. There are many. I didn't want to leave the impression that scientists don't. They're all over the place on that. There are some, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, the popular astronomer, mm-hmm. who goes around lecturing for atheist groups. He's so much of an atheist that he lectures. But there are plenty of scientists who do believe in God. You're right.
I think Carl Sagan was a believer, wasn't he?
Actually, he was not. He was not. He was a, let's call it an agnostic. He was not. No. Unfortunately, some believe it as superstition. And some scientists think that the belief in God actually sets back society and... because they say if you believe in God, you probably also believe Earth is only 5,000 years old, and that's not true. And so if you're going to believe false things, then you're anti-science, and you get into all sorts of places with that. I don't even want to go into this.
It's amazing stuff. What do you think the latest technology will do for astronomy?
Well, with the bigger and bigger telescopes, and, of course, with the new James Webb about to be launched later this year, I just wish they weren't putting it up on the far side of the moon. I think this is going to be an amazing technology. It's an infrared telescope, so it can detect wavelengths of objects that are moving so fast that the light has shifted into the invisible infrared. So this is going to be very, very cool what it can do. But I wish they were not putting it where it cannot be serviced. Remember how Hubble kept breaking down? And
yeah, we kept sending astronauts up there to tweak it.
You can't get up to this one once it's launched. It'll be on the far side of the moon and unreachable, and I wish they hadn't put it there.
Why are they putting it there? What's the rationale?
Well, because it'll be farther removed from any influences from Earth's light and Earth's heat, and so it's an ideal place to put it, at a Lagrangian place where the gravity balances out the moon, sun, and Earth's, so it can just sit there and hover there permanently. But as I said, not ever being able to repair it, I don't know. That's kind of taking a chance, don't you think?
Let's go to Steve in Casa Grande, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Hey, Steven, welcome.
Hey, how you been?
Okay, my friend. You're my Elvis buddy, right?
That's right.
That's okay. You. Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to say I love this conversation, and I wanted to get his take on, the miracle, the fascinating of time and space, time will, as far as we can conceive, it will elapse forever. It has elapsed forever, so you got the infinite nature of that. Then you've got the infinite nature of space where, say you go all the way to the edge of the universe, then you can keep on going. There's no limit going outward, but then it's also inward. Like if you take an atom and cut it into a million pieces, take one of those pieces, cut that into a million pieces, so you can go infinitely inward as well in our mind. And then the other one I wanted to ask him about is like with temperature. Like can't you go, you can go hotter than the sun, and then can you infinitely keep getting hotter to where there is no limit? Like say you get to the hottest point you can possibly go, can you go a little hotter? And the same with cold. Go as cold as you can, and then maybe you can just go a little colder and a little cold. Like anything that you can measure, the infinite quality of the measuring, any number you take, you can always add another digit to it.
All right, well, I'll answer that. Let me take that last one first.
We're gonna hit the break soon, Bob, so we'll let you finish up, but go ahead.
Okay. Hotter, yes, you can always get hotter and hotter because heat is just the motion of atoms. So you can always have something moving faster. Atoms moving faster would mean the thing is hotter. But you can't keep going with cold. So when you said there's infinite numbers, you can always add one more. No, because since temperature is, or heat is, motion of atoms, there's a place where atoms just come to a stop, and that's at 459.67 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. At that point, all atomic motion stops. We call that absolute zero, and you can't get colder than that.
We're going to come back in a moment and take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, I'll be chatting with Neil Slade about the power of the mind and the brain. Looking forward to that. And then, of course, those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Bob Berman, as we are talking about all things space. Bob, why is humankind, so fascinated with the cosmos?
Oh, gee. Well, I think, first of all, it takes us out of ourselves, our problems, our relationships, politics, and everything else. You look into the sky, like you yourself said, when you were a kid and you looked at the rings of Saturn.
Loved it.
It was like nothing else, nothing earthly. And so then, secondly, we know it's big and it's vast and it's permanent, and things around us tend not to be. As our beloved pet cat or dog passes away, well, Saturn is not going to pass away, and so we're really taken out of ourselves, and there's beauty, there's intellectual enjoyment, because all of it is like meanings and science behind it all. So it offers us a lot in a lot of different ways.
So do you think the sun is heating up to the point where that's the cause of climate change?
Well, no, it's monitored. Of course, 1,633 watts of solar energy per meter on Earth. So it's very, very, very carefully monitored. A little bit over one kilowatt for every, if you spread a sheet on the ground, and that sheet is just about 1 yard on the side, that you'll have a little over 1 kilowatt of energy from that. And that does not change very much. Of course, it does over the 11-year sunspot cycle, but that mostly changes in the ultraviolet, not in the visible part of the wavelengths. Now, what's mostly doing it is carbon dioxide. We see this everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of guessing, because Venus is the hottest place in the solar system, hottest surface, because its atmosphere is almost pure CO2. Mars is much more comfortable than it should be because its atmosphere, thin as it is, it's only 1% as thick as ours, but that little atmosphere is all CO2. So everywhere we see CO2, we see a warming. So when our CO2 went from 280 parts per million in 1880 and has been rising to where it's now, hard to believe I'm saying this, 405 parts per million, 280 to 405, that's a huge increase, and it must produce a warming on the Earth. What's funny is that people don't understand how simple it is. It's actually a very simple process, and I don't know if this is the place, but in 20 seconds I can explain how it works and why it's not theoretical, and why it's a good
idea.
Yeah,
go ahead. Do it. Go ahead.
Okay. It's like this. You know how the sun warms up the ground during the day?
Right.
And at night, that same heat radiates into space in the form of infrared rays, goes straight up into space. Okay, that's the basis of what goes on. Now, here's what happens. In clear, dry air, each bit of infrared or warmth from the surface goes in a straight line, escapes from Earth, goes into space, and the ground cools overnight, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if the infrared strikes anything with three or more atoms, it doesn't continue in a straight line. It gets absorbed by that molecule and then re-radiated randomly. So what has three or more atoms? Not oxygen, that comes in twos, O2. Not the nitrogen, which is most of our air, that comes in twos, N2. Not the argon that makes up the rest of the atmosphere. No, what has three or more is water vapor, H2O, that's three atoms. Carbon dioxide, there's very little carbon dioxide. There's only 1/25 of 1%. It's almost not there. But the little bit that is there has three atoms. And water vapor and carbon dioxide, so here's what happens. Each little bit of heat trying to go up into space hits one of these molecules, gets absorbed for a fraction of a second, and then escapes in random directions, George, including back down. And that's the entire secret of climate change or global warming or the effect of carbon dioxide. The fact that some of that doesn't keep going into space, a little of it gets radiated back to the ground, and stops the ground from heating, from cooling down as much overnight, which is why on cloudy nights, we know it's warmer. You know, the meteorologist, the weather guy, always says, tonight we have a blanket of clouds, so it's not going to get too cold. That's why in deserts at night, where the clear air, it gets so cold.
That's right.
Because you have more water vapor in the form of clouds, and that stops the heat from continuing into space.
Good point.
CO2 does the same thing, and now you know the entire story.
There's I love it.
More to it than that.
Edward's with us in Pueblo, Colorado. Hey, Ed, go ahead.
Hey, George, thank you for taking my call.
Thank
I'm
you.
I'm a little nervous because I'm the first-time caller. The thing is that with his knowledge and everything, what I want to ask is vitriol, V-I-T-R-I-O-L, vitriol. I'm a Christian. I believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get vitriol? It's amazing. I don't understand it. So maybe your guests can expound on that. Maybe. I mean, I apologize.
Isn't vitriol anger? Isn't that what you mean?
Yes.
It's cruel, bitter criticism. It's got all that in there.
So what's your question?
Let's go back and get him. Go ahead, Ed.
Vitriol.
Yeah, what's the question about it, though?
Why, as humans, do we have vitriol?
Well, now, is that for you to answer, Bob, or do you want me to take a stab at that?
Oh, please, you do it. I would think that would be a psychologist's question.
Well, I think if one is spiritual and believes in evil and the devil, you know, when the fallen angels were developed, it created this form of evil that has permeated mankind, and it's in us. This bitterness, this hatred, it's part of the humankind, unfortunately. It shouldn't be, but it is. How about that answer, Robbie? Next up, let's go to Billy in Austin, Texas. Welcome to the show. Hi, Billy.
Good morning, George and Bob.
Hi there.
On the discussion about the Big Bang, I think of it as the normal reverse procedure that we think of E equals MC squared, where we come from infinite energy to matter.
Well, that's an interesting take. You're coming up with these.
And there was scientific truth to that, and that it started out everything at the Big Bang. Everything was so incredibly hot that you couldn't even have matter at that point. You had just pure energy, and eventually you had matter. In fact, we know it was 389,000 years after the Big Bang that you had the first atoms forming of matter. So you're right. We started with the intense energy, and then matter came from that.
Of all the scientists out there, Bob, past and present, which one is your hero?
Oh, gee. Well, like everybody else, I loved Einstein. I loved the people who started quantum theory. And, Newton, the great things he said.
Sure.
He was ahead of everybody else.
How about Galileo? Galileo, throw him in there.
I got to throw him in there. I agree.
They're all out there. Bill's in Los Angeles. Take it away, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, George and Bob.
Hi.
Hi,
I got to put in a word for Sir Karl Popper, if I could.
Okay, add him to the mix.
Right. For what it's worth, I went to, I'm the guy who went to school with Michael Shermer, the skeptic here in Glendale.
Oh, sure thing. Okay, that's right.
Yeah, and I'm tracking pretty well with most of what Mr. Berman says, except what he said about consciousness. I think I heard him say that there was never a time when we were unaware or in oblivion, and I think I can politely refute that by pointing out to, for example, the day before each of us was conceived.
All right.
Can I rebut that?
Absolutely.
Logically, I agree with what you're saying. It seems to make sense. But I'm saying subjectively, in terms of what we each experience, just as right now we experience stuff, we're thinking, we're seeing, we're hearing, etc. We're always experiencing things. What we say in biocentrism, and I think we prove it through physics of all crazy things, is that there's never a time that you don't experience things. And I'm not saying, well, what if before you were conceived? What if? I'm talking about what you can vouch for yourself. And has there ever been a time when you're not aware? You'll find that there will never be a time that you're not aware of something or other. They'll always experience things.
Bob, do you think consciousness is part of the brain or outside of the brain?
I think it sort of works that consciousness is eternal, that is eternal, and each brain is sort of like a filtering mechanism on each animal or person that grabs a piece of it and filters it and experiences it so that we can have individual experiences, a dog experiencing the universe through sniffing and smells, we experiencing it mostly visually, etc., so we can have personal and unique experiences as the brain grabs that. But when the brain dies, when the body dies, we're back to that eternal experience of everything being one, and it's a much more blissful and amazing experience then.
Let's go to Rock Hills, South Carolina. Barry's with us. Hey, Barry, how you feeling these days?
Matter of fact, I'm doing just great, George, and thank you for asking. And boy, oh boy, what a fascinating program tonight.
Indeed.
This Don has got a head full of brains.
You're very kind.
But listen, I've got a good question for him. But before I do, George, please, when you do open lines tonight, Friday, I would love for you to tell me in the audience one more time the story behind UFO Phil.
Okay, we'll do that.
That is a fascinating story, and I'd love to hear it again. And he is just a dynamite song. I never get tired of hearing it.
It'll be on again tomorrow night, too.
Okay, and for you, Don, I told Tommy, I said, is this a little bit off the beaten path, but what do you think life after life is? I don't call it life after death. I call it life after life. But what do you think that's really like?
Well, again, that experiences never stop, that we'll always be aware of something. And so in a real sense, there's no death. And I think once freed from the body, it would be a very, very blissful thing, an experience that mystics and saints through the centuries have experienced. I experienced it when I was 20 in a real gift, let's say a gift from heaven myself. So I know it's real. And I think it's the most blissful, amazing, and truthful and clear experience you can have. So I think that's what happens after the body dies.
In terms of science, pure science, if there's one thing that fascinates you, what would that be, Bob?
Well, it's what we were talking about before, the relationship between consciousness, our own awareness, and the material universe. It started with the quantum geniuses, Max Planck and Heisenberg and all the rest, showing that experiments that we did, look up double-slit experiment, that the way the experiment turns out depends upon whether someone's looking, watching, and how we observe actually changes the electron from being a wave to a particle. So that if we really influence nature just by looking at it, well, that shows an interconnectedness. That's the whole thing behind biocentrism. It shows that we're all connected, that nature and us as observers are part of a single essence.
We've got David in Minnesota. Let's grab you in here, Dave. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I'm one of these first-time callers. Been listening to you since 09. And my theory was that these smaller quantum particles are like a London fog that, like if you were going through it before the Big Bang, all these particles were just filled up the whole, I don't know, you wouldn't say atmosphere, but it... So, like, if you go through it, so if you cause a wave going through that, through the fog, it would spin these particles, and they would turn into quarks, and then the quarks would turn into particles, and then that would be the beginning of the Big Bang. But it was all of these particles all of a sudden started having gravity, and it's pulling all these particles together. And then when the sort of like when God spoke, he caused the disturbance to make the particles turn, move, cause gravity. And then it was all this string theory goes with that. It's the pulling of all this together causes like that Big Bang starting.
Interesting comments. We've got some of the world's greatest callers, Bob, that a radio station and show could ever have. Thanks again, Bob, for being on the program. We really appreciate it. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.